This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
In order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Last week, President Trump followed through on a campaign promise to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. This 2015 agreement involved 195 countries. They promised to set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions to limit the rise in average global temperatures. But during the campaign, the president called climate change a hoax and made a point of putting America first, which he says this decision does.
As president, I can put no other consideration before the well-being of American citizens. The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries, leaving American workers, who I love, and taxpayers to absorb the cost in terms of lost jobs, lower wages, shuttered factories, and vastly diminished economic production.
Opponents of the president's decision say it isolates the U.S. from the global community. Only two other countries, Nicaragua and Syria, failed to sign on to the climate accord, and opponents say it hands the mantle of leadership over to other nations, most particularly China. But the president has left the door open to negotiating a new agreement that will be fairer, he says, to America, and he's agreed to abide by the terms of withdrawal, a process that will take another 4 years, another election cycle. Here to talk about the accord, this decision to withdraw, and what all of this could mean to the United States and to the global climate is Brian Maggi. He's an associate professor of atmospheric sciences in the Department of Geography and Earth Sciences at UNC Charlotte. Good morning and welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
He joins us in our studio, and with us from Washington is Camila Domonoske, who has covered the Paris Accord extensively for NPR. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And she, by the way, is a graduate of Davidson College. Welcome back. Welcome home.
Yeah, happy to be here.
And WFAE's environmental reporter David Borax is also with us. Good morning, David.
Yeah, hello, Mike.
Good morning. You, by the way, you can watch today's program and make comments on Facebook Live. You just look for WFAE on Facebook. That's where you'll find us. There were people with the administration, including Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, former head of ExxonMobil, who favored the Paris Accord, and other major companies. Many major companies are on board with this agreement, but the president said it was a bad deal for the country and its workers. Camila, is it?
Well, one of the key things to parse out when you're looking at the Paris Accord is the difference between the agreement between all of the countries about the overarching goals and how each country plans to actually implement their portion of the goal. So the method for actually reducing emissions isn't defined in the accord, which means that a lot of the criticisms that people who say that the accord would hurt the coal industry or hurt workers in America, those various implementation methods aren't mandated by the accord. So it's not accurate to say that that's the accord that you're even criticizing in the first place.
The president has called the terms draconian and a massive, this is a quote, a massive redistribution of America's wealth to other nations, and said that this agreement is less about the climate and more about other countries gaining a financial advantage over the United States. Is that true?
You know, you can go out on the internet and find some of the major news organizations that have gone through this speech point by point. And, you know, there's four or five major points that he made, including that one, which are pretty easy to debunk right away. So I'm not sure that one is true. You know, in many ways, this is not about specific points in an agreement that are somehow hurting the U.S. It's about Trump trying to finish what the governors, many of the governors, started, which was opposing President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which, going back to what Camila just said, the Clean Power Plan was President Obama's proposal for how we would implement the Paris Accords. And so it's really more about opposing that than it is about anything in some contract somewhere.
But in response to this withdrawal from the Paris Accord, a lot of mayors around the country, a lot of governors, a lot of industrial leaders have said they're going to proceed as though nothing had happened, or they will do what they can do to hold up the details of the Paris Accord. How unusual is that, Camila?
I think it has been a really remarkable pushback against the federal government. I mean, not that there haven't been conflicts between, you know, state and local governments and the federal government before, but the really immediate and impassioned and really similar responses from a lot of mayors has been really striking, I think.
Well, you've said that some of these details were not defined or not spelled out, not mandated by this mm-hmm. accord, and so therefore we may not have been bound to any particular course of behavior. But were the terms more onerous for the United States than for other countries? Were we asked to pay more money? Were we asked to be more restrictive in our emissions, et cetera? Was it harder on us?
There are two big groups of countries that are treated differently under the accord. There are developed countries, wealthy countries, and developing countries. And one of the things that the accord calls for is for money to be transferred from wealthier countries to less wealthy countries. That doesn't necessarily mean taxpayer dollars, federal funding. That includes money from private entities in wealthy countries. And it doesn't specify X amount of dollars from the United States. It's a communal goal for the entire pool of wealthy countries. So it is fair to say that there are demands placed on developed countries in general mm-hmm. that aren't placed on developing countries, but not fair to say that that's the United States specifically being called out for these funding purposes.
Were the guidelines any more onerous, David, for the United States in terms of our financial, putting us at a financial disadvantage?
I guess that depends on how you calculate the cost of carrying out the Clean Power Plan. And, you know, that is actually something that's being disputed in court right now, so that may never happen. But financially, you know, it probably was going to affect governments. It was going to affect companies. But as you mentioned a minute ago, many of them are already preparing. And so, you know, at a disadvantage, I think this is money that was already going to be spent.
In fact, Victor Flatt, who is co-director of the Center for Climate, Energy, Environment, and Economics at UNC Chapel Hill, has said this decision will, quote, hamper international competitiveness even at the state level in a place like North Carolina, which has already been reeling from other things. How might this harm North Carolina in terms of being competitive in the world?
That's a great question. Again, it comes back to who's going to be subject to all of the requirements under whatever plan the U.S. comes up with. So let's take the Clean Power Plan as the policy that the state was going to have to carry out. First of all, the state challenged it right out of the box because we are led by Republicans. The Republican governor, Pat McCrory at the time, made an announcement opposing the Clean Power Plan. You know, I don't know if there's a dollar amount for how much it would cost companies here, but it would require them to continue doing what many have already been doing, which is to adopt cleaner policies, equipment.
There are companies around the country, including Duke Energy here in Charlotte, that have already pledged to do these things, to be cleaner, et cetera, to pursue clean energy policies. So are governments, are state governments that are opposing this climate accord, is the federal government and their opposition to this climate accord, are they behind the curve on this?
You know, I don't think this is really about money in the end. I think it's about politics. And, you know, I think this is about the governors that opposed the Clean Power Plan initially didn't like Obama. They didn't want him to get to carry out a policy that.
But isn't this cutting off your nose to spite the face, spite your face? Everybody has to breathe. Everybody has to drink water. If this is going to make the air cleaner, if it's going to lower carbon emissions, and if that is going to ward off global warming or climate change or whatever you want to call it, isn't that rather ignorant?
Well, it is, but now we have to go back to the other thing. You just mentioned the idea of climate change itself, and there are a lot of people who either don't believe it or won't believe it or oppose the idea of working on it because they feel like they're being disadvantaged. I mean, that's – President Trump was – his speech was all about playing into those concerns that many people have.
Why are companies – Brian Maggie is with us. He's an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at UNC Charlotte. Why are companies like ExxonMobil, that's in the fossil fuel industry, Why are they on board with this climate accord?
Well, I think the writing is on the wall in a lot of ways. The transition to a different type of energy system is underway. I think Duke Energy reads this. I think all the big energy companies in the world see this in one way or another. And so they've promoted the idea that they want to be at the table in the discussions around the Paris Agreement, how it is that the what would have been the, you know, the voluntary contributions from the U.S. to reduce their emissions. The coal companies wanted to talk about that. They wanted to talk about how they saw themselves in the future. So I think by, like you said, I mean, cutting themselves out of this agreement, I think is very short-sighted.
Before becoming Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson was the head of ExxonMobil, and he was in favor of the Paris Accord. And I think he tried to talk the president into staying the course on this, and the president instead listened to Steve Bannon and I believe the Secretary of help me out here, David.
The EPA Secretary.
The EPA Secretary, thank you.
Scott Pruitt.
Scott Pruitt, and who is not in favor of this and, in fact, has been a climate change denier. And Camila, you reported recently that ExxonMobil shareholders have asked the company to publicly disclose how this fight against climate change could affect the company's bottom line. Is that likely to happen?
Well, the board said they were going to take it very seriously. I mean, it was a strong majority of the ballots that were cast in favor of this. And this was a major win for environmental activists who are trying to push these major multinational corporations to really plan for a future where there are serious efforts to fight climate change and crunch the numbers and think about how they would succeed in that world, because that will put more resources behind actually changing the status quo.
So is this a request by shareholders an effort to shake the company, shake some sense into the company and say, don't cooperate with this because you'll hurt the bottom line? Or is it a way to shake the company into looking at alternative energy sources and getting on board before anybody else does?
Yeah, I think it's a way of shaking the company and saying, start planning for a future where the world is actually seriously fighting climate change and think about what that would look like for you. Don't act as though things are going to continue business as usual for the foreseeable future.
And a world where your major product is no longer in the big demand that it was, if that ever happens.
And the extraction of that major product is at risk under future climate change scenarios as well. So the shareholders, you know, share a financial risk, and that they want Exxon to be honest about that, and other companies want to be honest about that as well.
Until this country announced its intention to pull out all of the major nations of the world, including North Korea, had signed on to this climate accord. Only Nicaragua and Syria had not, for whatever their reasons. Put that into some sort of historical perspective where everybody's on board but two and now three nations.
You know, one thing that comes to mind is the formation of the United Nations did not include all the countries of the world initially. So, I mean, this was very significant in that respect.
And there's still some signatories, I believe, riding the fence. They've signed the agreement, but they're not fully on board. Russia is among those nations. Will our pullout make them less anxious to finalize the deal? Maybe let them give them a reason to back away from this deal?
I think that's one of the fears for certain. And, you know, it's even broader than that. It's not just about whether countries will be willing to not fully commit to the deal, but whether countries that have already signed on to the deal will take this as a signal that they don't have to take it very seriously. One of the things to really emphasize about the Paris Accord is that it's a package of goals and it's voluntary. And that means that how things are actually executed is essential.
Yeah. I want to come back to that non-binding voluntary nature of this agreement in just a moment. We have to take a break. Camila Domonoske is a reporter for NPR who has covered this extensively, along with David Borax, our environmental reporter, and Brian Maggie from UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training job seekers, and offering health care and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. And Henderson Properties, a full-service real estate investment company serving the Charlotte region for over 26 years, from purchase negotiations to renovations and managing the rental. Henderson is committed to its clients. InvestHP.com. Well, listeners in South Carolina are just weeks away from the special election to decide who will take the seat in the 5th Congressional District vacated when Mick Mulvaney became President Trump's budget director. That district stretches from York and Lancaster counties down to the PD region, and this race is seen as one of 5 in the country as early referenda on the Trump administration. We talked to both the Republican and Democratic candidates on this program tomorrow at 9.
A number that speaks louder than a name.
I am about 285, give or take. I'm very active, but I'm obese.
The why behind pounds and ounces, science, psychology, and just plain prejudice. A series on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
That's this afternoon at 2 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE, as well as Facebook Live. I'm Mike Collins. Brian Maggie is with us, Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences in the Department of Geography and Earth Sciences at UNC Charlotte. He's here to give us the lowdown on climate science as we get into that aspect of the Paris Accord. Camila Domonoske and David Borax are both reporters. Camila is with NPR. David, of course, is WFAE, and they're both environmental reporters, and they're here to talk about the decision last week by the president to pull out of the Paris Accord. And as he pointed out in his Rose Garden speech, provisions of the accord were non-binding. So why pull out, David?
Well, it's because of what was going to come after that. And we talked about it earlier. Each country was supposed to come up with its own plan for doing this. This accord was signed by President Obama, and he proposed the Clean Power Plan, which basically was a mandate to all the states to come up with their own. So it's being passed down the line from the federal government to the states. And so each state was supposed to say how it was going to meet certain goals for emissions. And, you know, it was primarily targeting power generation, so, you know, coal-fired power plants. And North Carolina has already been doing a lot. You know, we had the Clean Smokestacks Act about 20 years ago, I think it was, that has significantly reduced carbon emissions from the power industry. Our largest utility, Duke Energy, has already closed half of its coal-fired power plants in the state. And so there are things underway already. The question was, how fast would they get rid of the rest of them and shift towards cleaner forms of energy? Duke Energy is putting a lot of efforts into gas. There's also, of course, solar and wind power. So But it gets passed down the line to the states. Nothing was happening at the state level. So, you know, it was so non-binding that, you know, many states were not acting on it yet.
So why not take a wait-and-see attitude on this as opposed to pulling out now?
I just come back to what I said earlier. It's all about politics.
Well, all right. Speaking of politics, there are many Western industrialized nations with very conservative governments who signed onto this without batting an eye. And if you want to say that we have a Republican control of the government in most states and Republican control of the federal government, and therefore we have conservative government as well, why are we taking a different stance on this when other conservative governments around the country have just jumped into the water and said, let's do it? Camila?
I think one thing that really came through in President Trump's speech was the idea that the rest of the world wants the U.S. to participate, and that being framed as something that he was deeply skeptical about. So there's a tension within this administration between people who are very engaged with the international community and people who are fiercely anti-globalist and see the idea of world cooperation as a threat to American sovereignty. I mean, I don't think I'm overstating the case there. So that
I believe he used the word sovereignty, didn't he, in his speech?
Yeah. So the idea that this is a threat to American independence simply by the nature that it's an agreement between all the countries of the world, which is a pretty remarkable stance and sort of suggests that there are very deep ideological things at play here, completely separate from the climate issue. He talked very little about climate, really.
20 Republican senators urged the president to withdraw from the deal. But in yesterday's New York Times, a front page article pointed out that protecting the environment was once a part of the GOP election playbook. The article pointed out that an old John McCain campaign commercial praising George W. Bush for sounding the alarm for global warming was a major component of the campaign, and that was only 9 years ago. What has changed and why?
I'm not sure all that much has changed, Mike. I mean, citizens of most of those Western developed countries that you mentioned, there are large environmental movements, and it is pretty much a given that we need to do work on the environment, you know, that humans have an effect on it.
That campaign commercial used the words global warming, words that are not uttered by Republicans today. By and large.
Those are words uttered by some Republicans. We haven't lost it entirely. But, you know, you mentioned the letter from the 20 senators, and if we could look at it maybe a little cynically for just a moment, there was an article in The Guardian over the weekend that itemized the campaign donations from oil, coal, and gas industries to those 20 senators, who include, by the way, Tim Scott from South Carolina and Tom Tillis from North Carolina. Both of them have gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars from these interests. So, looking at it cynically, perhaps there is an element here of the political system that we live in.
That same Times article says there were several reasons for this shift, chief among them a campaign carefully crafted by the fossil fuel industry, most notably by the Koch brothers, and because of the dominance of Republican constituents who are genuinely threatened by policies that would raise the cost of burning fossil fuels like coal. So, could it be argued that the Paris Accord hastened this reversal in the Republican Party? The very existence of it caused people to jump on and push in the opposite direction.
I think that's fair to say, you know, that the fact that we actually joined this international agreement, and it was done by, again, Democratic President Obama, created a target for people who were on the other side. And, you know, again, I'm not sure that that there are vast numbers who still don't agree with climate change. But I do think that, you know, the politics here have dictated that it at least look that way. And a campaign like this can help win advantages for Republicans when they get to other issues.
Well, let's talk about that. Brian, Maggie, one of the arguments made by those opposed to the Paris Accord is whatever climate change we've experienced so far is something that's merely cyclical. The world goes through these cyclical changes, ice ages, warm time periods, etc. And the same people sometimes continue to assert that the climate scientists have not come to an agreement on this. Mm-hmm. Where does the truth lie?
Well, as a member of the climate science community, I would say that that is a complete falsehood at that point. So at this point, the evidence is absolutely clear. The Earth is warming.
If you polled climate scientists today,
yes,
what percentage of them would say we are experiencing global warming?
If you find climate experts, right, if you actually look at the people that are studying the system actively, you would find 90 to 95 or more percent of all climate scientists agree that the climate system is changing.
And how do you explain those who don't agree? Even if it's only 4%, why don't they agree?
Well, there's always going to be some skepticism about science, and this is healthy, right?
Even among scientists,
sure, but it's a small fraction.
And of the climate scientists out there, how many would attribute global warming to man-made causes?
No, I think that's still greater than 90% at that.
How do we know it's not cyclical? Because we have had deep ice ages and things like
that. Yeah, no, this is part of the beautiful part. This is the beautiful part of the science, right? This is the part that's exempt from politics in some ways, at least scientists like to see it. And in that regard, we have the scientific method that sort of parses out what the different causes could be for the current global warming. And then through the scientific method of inquiry, evidence gathering, evidence-based arguments, peer review science, and over the course of decades and decades of research, they find that it couldn't be the sun, it couldn't be El Nino type of variability in the climate system. It has to be the increase in carbon dioxide gas and other greenhouse gases.
And without teaching a seminar in climate science, why do they think that? How do they rule out those other factors?
Through fundamental physics of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I mean, the same thing would be true and applied to the fundamental physics of sun interaction with the atmosphere and El Nino. But the problem is that the only one that can actually explain the current global warming is the increase in carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas.
So you are prepared to say this morning that there is no question about this. It is not open to question as to whether or not the climate is changing, the globe is warming, and that we are the cause.
Absolutely. This is you can put all sorts of evidence. It's like a mountain compared to a molehill at this point in terms of the amount of evidence.
And when do we actually start keeping track of global temperatures?
In the late 1800s.
And so we can look back to the beginnings of the can we look back prior to the Industrial Revolution?
We have some observations. They're scant, and they become more and more isolated to parts of the world that have actually studied weather.
And can you trace the rise in global temperatures to the rise in the number of automobiles, to the increased production of electricity through coal-fired plants, et cetera? Can you really do that? Can you put it on a graph?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It looks almost visually, qualitatively, it looks almost exactly the same in terms of when the different change points are.
Some say that we are at this tipping point in terms of our effect on the environment, and in fact, we may have already passed it. What's your take on that?
Wow, that's the scary one. That's the one where you start to perturb this massive Earth system that we live on. This is the global perspective. This is much, much bigger than the politics of a particular country, right? But it's at this point, you start to push the system and you warm the Earth, and the Earth doesn't just sit passively in a warmer state. Other things start to respond, right? And this is where you have things like the ice caps melting is probably the one that we can all think about. When it gets warmer, ice melts. And so as a result, that's going to have repercussions throughout the Earth system. And so those are the tipping points that we look for. Have we pushed the ice sheets too far so that they can't possibly reform in any reasonable amount of time due to normal natural variations in the climate system?
And the reason they couldn't reform, even if we are successful at reversing this, if we all stopped using oil today, I'm told, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would take, what, decades to remove itself?
More than that. We're talking centuries to thousands of years.
And it takes centuries to thousands of years to build these ice caps back up.
That's right. So what we're fundamentally doing by putting carbon dioxide in particular into the atmosphere is altering the fundamental chemical state of the atmosphere.
So the president
for thousands of years.
The president said in his speech last week in the Rose Garden that he cares deeply about the environment. But he has also said that climate change is not a priority for his administration, and he's called climate change a hoax. Can you have it both ways? Can you care deeply about the environment and not take steps to change the climate?
Well, I think if you could kind of philosophically go back and forth, but I think at some point you have to kind of recognize that the environment that you're in is changing. And I think everybody does when you live in your own environment and wherever you are in the country, whatever part of the country, or however you vote, you end up seeing small changes. And when what kind of is hard, I think, for each of us individually to perceive is how not just the observations we make, but how our neighbors and how other people around us are seeing the same changes. Mm-hmm. And when you compile all that, then you start to see it's not just my environment that's changing. It's not just my crops that are changing, but it's that the environment as a whole is changing.
Talk about these, because small changes are difficult to see. So talk about these small changes. What should we be looking for? Have we noticed that we probably maybe didn't describe to climate change?
There are all sorts of indications that the planet is warming, and this is part of the different lines of evidence that scientists collect. But then you look also to other impacts that a warmer world will have on things like that we experience every day, like the weather system. And so stronger, more intense rainfall events, for example, are something that are expected and that we've already started to see as a result of the warmer atmosphere that we live in compared to, say, 50 to 100 years ago.
But there are people who will say, well, that's weather. Mm-hmm. That's not climate. That's weather.
Oh, sure, it's weather.
It rains, it snows, it's hot, it's cold. It's
but weather. The weather is happening in a warmer world, and that's what it is. And so you have these kind of effects where you see not only weather, but then you start to take the coastal communities. And in North Carolina, this is a big deal, where we have sea levels rising all around the world at various rates. But then as a storm moves in, you're going to have weather, but the weather happens and pushes more water that's higher up than it used to be, just a little bit, but it pushes it further into the community that was developed around the idea that sea level was going to stay constant. And it's not constant.
Do you think that our pullout from this accord will have any impact on the success or failure of this accord?
I think takes away the momentum that we had at the federal level, the leadership that we had at the federal level, or at least detracts from it pretty significantly. And that seems to be what I think David and Camelia are both talking about, is the idea that this creates somewhat of a vacuum at the top level in the United States. And I think, you know, we'll look to states, we'll look to cities to actually step into that void.
From what you know about the terms of the Paris Accord and the goals that it sets for stopping global temperature rise, if the signatories all do what they say they will do and they follow this to the letter, can it have an impact?
I think Paris is never intended to solve everything that we've done. It's intended to push us in the right direction, and the right direction being to reduce carbon emissions. And that's the scientific perspective. And in, as a scientist, the absolute goal for a scientist is to say, and I think most scientists would agree, I'm speaking for a community here, so it's a little dangerous, but the idea is that you want to go to zero carbon emissions. And that's fundamentally the goal that you want to be at. And it's going to be extremely challenging. And so what the Paris Agreement did was it allowed other countries to individually determine their contributions to reducing global carbon emissions by ratcheting down, not just dropping and saying we're going to stop all coal burning tomorrow, because that would be, I mean, even as an idealized scientist kind of in that viewpoint, I know that's not possible. So the ratcheting down is what was so impressive at the global scale. And this is the first time we've come to an agreement at a global scale that would have included the United States, because the United States was at the negotiating table making sure that this position was well known. They advocated for themselves in a very strong way, different from Kyoto, for example.
So let me ask two questions, because it's clear that even though the nation as a whole, under the guidance of the Trump administration, is not going to cooperate with this. They made that announcement last week. There are companies already deciding that they will cooperate. There are mayors of cities who are deciding that they will cooperate. So if everybody in the world follows the accord to the T and we do nothing, do we put the kibosh on the whole thing? Do we ruin it? Can they achieve their goals? And if everybody in the world does precisely what they say they will do, and some companies and some cities in the United States do what the accord says to do, can they accomplish it? Two different questions.
I think that's the hope. I mean, you're right. You know, in the wake of President Trump's speech last week, we've heard many people coming out and saying, well, we still support the accord. There's petitions out there on the internet. Sign this to show that you support the accord. There's millions of Americans have signed that as individuals. Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York has said that he would put up the money to help the United States stay in the accord. Mm-hmm. You know, many companies came out with statements after it saying that they were still committed to the same principles that they had been before. And, you know, I mean, we talked earlier about Duke Energy. Duke Energy puts out this sustainability report every year that says this is our goal for cutting emissions. And they've done so well since they started this a few years back that they are now raising the bar for themselves to cutting emissions by 40% from 2005 levels. So I think that there is momentum still. The big question is whether other countries will do what you're saying and stick with it. I think this does create an opening, as Camilla said earlier, for them to say, well, maybe we're not going to follow it. And then the whole thing falls apart.
President Trump called China and India the world's leading polluters. And he characterized us, the United States, as being...
That wasn't entirely accurate, by the way.
It's not true.
Well, I'm getting to that. He characterized the United States as the world's leader in environmental protection. Parse those comments, Camila.
I mean, there's a long list of things in that speech that were deeply problematic and fundamentally inaccurate. I mean, I would leave this actually to the climate experts to talk about the relative levels of impact of different countries. If you want to take that,
sure. Point. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe you could say we lead the world in environmental regulations, which is ironic considering that one of the main proponents of backing out of the Paris Agreement was Scott Pruitt, who is very anti-regulation. Right. I would be very strong regulation. So it's, I mean, in the sense of from the science perspective, it would be nice to have a science advising the EPA on that policy.
Good luck with that.
Right. I'm discouraged by that. But then the other side of that discussion is the carbon pollution. And carbon is a pollutant by the Supreme Court's ruling in 2009.
Well, let's come back and talk about that when we return, because he said that China and India are the worst and we're the best. And we'll get the numbers on that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Biggs Camera, committed to the needs of professional and amateur photographers since 1959, offering new and used cameras as well as full online printing services, rentals, and more. Details at BiggsCamera.com. Following the latest UK terror attack, Prime Minister Theresa May is calling for new internet regulations to, in her words, deprive extremists of their safe spaces online. She criticized internet service providers and tech companies for allowing extremism to breed. What could cyber regulation look like? Should the internet be blamed for terrorism? The topic of On Point this morning with guest host Anthony Brooks. By the way, you can also watch what remains of today's program and make comments on Facebook Live. Just look for WFAE on Facebook. We're coming right back.
Adam Stevens, Principal, the British International School of Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
As an international school, one of our core demographics is families that are looking for a broader and deeper interpretation of the world. WFAE's global coverage and the depth of their analysis attracts that kind of discerning listener that we're looking for. The decision to be an underwriter with WFAE was a really easy one. It's just a really good fit.
Email underwriting at WFAE.org for information.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with David Borax, our environmental reporter at WFAE. Camila Domonoske is a reporter for NPR who covers this topic extensively. And Brian Maggie is an assistant professor of atmospheric sciences in the Department of Geography and Earth Sciences at UNC Charlotte. We were talking just prior to the break about the president's comments that China and India are the world's worst polluters. You took issue with that, Brian. And he also said that we are the world's leader in environmental protection. But China and the U.S. were the top emitters per kiloton of, I think, carbon in 2015. And in fact, Americans emitted more than twice as much as the Chinese and over eight times as much as Indians per capita in 2015. So we are not the cleanest country in the world. We're the worst.
You
are
got
we
it.
The worst?
Well, per capita, yes. We're the biggest country that we have in terms of the highest emissions. Like if we put the rank them, you just said that. So China, U.S., and India are the top three emitters in annual emissions. But then if you look at that per capita, then we're the top emitter per person for a top emitting nation.
But do we have a choice? Seriously. I mean, we have a big country. We have it's an automobile-designed country.
Right.
You just can't turn that off.
And this is where the beauty of something like the Paris Agreement is, or the Clean Power Plan that underlies the Paris Agreement in terms of the U.S. is so apparent, is that we can actually ratchet this down and begin to move the vehicular fleet to electric vehicles, for example. Mm-hmm. And if that electricity is derived from sources that are not emitting a lot of carbon, like solar and wind, mm-hmm. a dominated electricity grid, then that is where we want to be.
We have an email from Ellen who said, can you talk about the payments the president said the U.S. would have to make in order to stay in the agreement? I'm not sure how specific she wants us to be, but go ahead, Camila.
The green climate.
Yeah, so talking about the idea of providing funding for developing countries, a couple of key things about what's called for under the Paris Accord. This is money that's to be put up by developed countries in general, mm-hmm. not specifically one developed country and not specifically government funding, but any source of funding. Also, this is not a blank check that's written to developing countries. This is funding for specific initiatives to prevent climate change or to help mitigate the impact of climate change, particularly on really vulnerable countries that are experiencing, you know, rising ocean levels. And there are smaller countries that don't have the resources to prepare for that in the same way that, for instance, Miami Beach in America might have a lot of resources.
Were we being asked to contribute more than our fair share or a sizable portion larger than, say, France or Germany or England?
Well, the Obama administration had pledged a fairly substantial chunk of money, but that was not a requirement for the United States to remain in the accord specifically. So again, there was some intentional elision there of what was required by the accord and what were efforts that were being supported by the Obama administration. So it would have been possible, certainly, to remain in the accord and not pledge as much money as the Obama administration had pledged.
We have to come back to the idea that this is a voluntary agreement. It's basically, you know, we all got together and we said, look, we got this problem. Do we agree on that? One of the massive achievements of the Paris Accord is that everybody agreed this is a problem. And number two, they set a goal for how much they think we should improve the climate. So a degree and a half, keep it to a degree and a half rise over the next whatever it is, several decades. And all of the things under that are voluntary. The money that we're talking about would not come out of the U.S. Treasury. Some of it might, but some of it would come from private sources as well. And it's an agreement between all the countries to do something about this.
Dennis on Facebook writes, I've heard China is being very aggressive in their efforts to reduce carbon emissions. I know the air quality in Beijing has been horrendous. Is China truly going all out? Brian, is it?
They're moving to a much stronger renewable fraction of their overall energy portfolio, much more aggressively than the U.S., and that's partly stems from the idea that a lot of the pollution problems, air quality problems they're seeing, are related to the same pollutants that change the climate.
And we've talked about market forces here a little bit today, going all out toward moving toward a cleaner environment with use of cleaner fuels, with or without the Paris Accord and our cooperation in it. WFAE's Nick DeLaCanal spoke with David Doctor, the CEO of the Charlotte-based Energy Trade Association, E4 Carolinas, who said essentially the ship toward a cleaner future has already sailed.
With regard to what's happening here locally, the course is already well set. So when we take a look at a number of aspects of clean energy development, you'll see that the utilities almost uniformly throughout the Carolinas have adopted an approach where they're incorporating renewable energy, primarily solar, into their portfolios. Duke Energy has made a very strong statement with regard to its direction. It's not going to build new coal plants. And large energy consumers that look to locate in the state or even to continue to reside in the state are insisting that they be served from a clean energy portfolio.
So we're very Duke Energy-centric here because it's the biggest power company in the country and it's located here. But is this happening with other power companies around the country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the demand for this is coming from the ground up all over the country. Other large utilities have similar programs for doing this. And don't forget, it's not just climate change and the environment that's driving this, but the economics of the power industry have changed significantly. Coal is no longer cost efficient. We started with coal 40, 50 years ago because it was so cheap. You could just pull it out of the ground and burn it and you'd get electricity from that. That's no longer true, and it's no longer as cheap for a lot of reasons. I mean, right now we're in a situation where, like, for example, banks have stopped lending money to companies that extract coal. So that makes it more difficult for those companies. And, you know, what's happened now is natural gas has come to the fore as the replacement. Environmentalists, a lot of them don't like natural gas because it's still a fossil fuel, but it is cleaner burning than coal. And that is actually pretty cheap right now. So one of the reasons why your energy bill is not going up is because of natural gas.
And you have to drill for natural gas. You have to mine coal. You have to drill for oil. The sun and the wind are there. And once you build the windmills and the solar collectors, there's no cost. Isn't that driving part of this as well?
You know, when I hear people say that, I think about when I was a kid, my dad was a nuclear engineer, and he used to say, you know, he took me down to see the new nuclear plant under construction, and he'd say, it's going to be too cheap to meter, which is basically what you're saying. And, you know,
I've been told off the air by people who are in the electric industry that we're quickly approaching that it's too cheap to meter. And that's a problem for the electric industry.
Well, and I that may be. I mean, it certainly is going to be – once the equipment gets cheaper, it's going to be pretty cheap. But, you know, you still have to pay to construct this. You got to buy the land. You have to get the distribution lines to get it out to the grid. So there are costs, and they are coming down.
So where this is happening, where energy companies are changing over, where private companies are changing over, are they doing this, Camila, out of a sense of altruism and a sense of I want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem? Or are they doing it because it's just simply better for the bottom line?
Well, I mean, I can't peer into the hearts of every CEO in the country, and several of them might have deep down inside, you know, an altruistic impulse. But fundamentally, it's an economic decision, right? And we talked earlier about the word risk, and that's a major word that, looking ahead for long-term planning for the viability of major energy corporations, they're thinking about a lot of different kinds of risk, including the risk of increased regulation to fight climate change and the risks of climate change itself influencing their ability to make a profit. And there are, you know, massive investment opportunities in a growing energy sector in renewable resources. So I think that, yeah, it's a financial decision.
We haven't talked about this aspect of it, but one of the things Donald Trump focused on in his speech was the loss of jobs. And again, you know, he's talked about trying to revive the coal industry.
But aren't there more jobs in the solar industry?
Well, my point is that, you know, when you have tightened regulations like this, it can cause some jobs to go away, but it creates opportunities in other areas. So the renewable energy industry is one of the big areas of job growth in the country right now, including in our area.
And in North Carolina, right? I mean, we're number two in solar deployments.
What about West Virginia, though? I mean, can they replace those coal jobs in West Virginia with jobs in the wind power or the solar power industry? Or is the topography and the climate and the sunlight not sufficient for that?
Well, there might be two problems. I mean, there's one, you know, you have to train but then also there's a culture as well. So, I mean, you have to make sure that that culture of coal mining does feel like they're actually able to contribute to a right. different type of energy production.
I mean, West Virginia has actually got more jobs in the natural gas industry now than they had
yeah, right.
in the past
no,
because,
right.
because of fracking, and that's where that gas is coming from.
According to a Yale University study, 60% of North Carolina voters support staying in the Paris Climate Change Agreement. This is a fairly red state. Can the same be said of other red states?
Yes, absolutely. The polls are almost universal.
So there is popular demand
yes.
for this to be cleaner around. And I would think that's the case in other nations around the world that are participating in this. Is that right?
I haven't seen. Well, I'm sure. I'm just going to guess, yes. But for the U.S., at least, we can say not only is the public in support of the Paris Agreement, but also vastly in support of renewable energy.
So why isn't that? You talked about the political aspect of this, David. Why isn't that public support for this figuring into the politics of it?
You know, Donald Trump is always played to his base first. And so I think he his assumption is that his base doesn't like the Paris Accord. They don't like miners don't like it that they lost their jobs. Is he right? Well, when you play politics, you know, you go to your base first and then you try to expand it from there.
I mean, the coal miners in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio, I guess there are coal mines in Ohio, I don't know. They're a small portion of his base. Yes, he made promises to them.
It's symbolic. I mean, he wants to portray himself as the one who is saving America from whatever. You know, there was one of the famous lines was, "I don't represent Paris, I represent Pittsburgh,"
right.
Which was interesting. I read an article over the weekend. You know, actually Pittsburgh, 80% voted for Hillary Clinton. The mayor was in Paris during the negotiations over the accord. People in Pittsburgh overwhelmingly support the agreement. So his analogy there was a little bit off. I mean, my point is that, you know, he has this group that he is trying to appeal to, and this sort of thing works for that. It may not work over the long haul. I mean, we'll have an election in a few years.
The president said that exiting the agreement protects the United States from future intrusions on the United States sovereignty, which we have talked about, and massive future legal liability, which we have not talked about. Others say that exiting may actually open the U.S. to greater legal liabilities, in that staying in would not expose us to any legal action. What's the truth here, Camila?
Well, I mean, it's a non-binding international agreement, right? It's not going to have weight in U.S. courts. So there's a very strong case to be made, as far as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on international law regarding climate change, but as I understand it, essentially, it's a non-binding agreement, and it would not have held up weight in U.S. courts if President Trump were sued for failing to carry it out, which was essentially the case that was being made for the fact that it would open him up to lawsuits.
The key part of the Paris Accord, Brian, is to hold the increase in global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So that means we don't want the climate to be more than 2 degrees warmer than it was before the Industrial Revolution, right?
Yes.
So we've already experienced a 1 degree Celsius rise as compared to pre-industrial levels. What happens if we can't achieve that goal? I mean, paint a picture for us.
Wow. Well, let's see. So 2 degrees has been a discussion point in policy, science policy circles for now, decades relative to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
And because we're America, put the 2 degrees Celsius rise into Fahrenheit.
Sure. 2 times 1.8 would be Fahrenheit in that case. So that would be 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
That doesn't sound like a lot.
No, it doesn't sound like a lot. But remember, this is the entire Earth that we're warming, right?
Okay.
And so it's not just North Carolina, and we're not talking about seasonal weather. So we're adding a lot of energy to the Earth that wasn't there before by putting more stuff into the atmosphere.
So what does that mean? If we don't contain this temperature rise,
yeah.
What happens to the world? What does it look like where I live? What does it look like? You know, Washington, D.C. was built on a swamp. The White House is sitting on a swamp. Are they going to have to take up the carpets on the first floor? What's going on?
So you're going to experience a lot of different climate impacts, and this is where the environmental side of global warming is really important to remember. This is the global environmental changes that we're talking about that are a result of a warmer planet. And so you have everything from those stronger storms that I already mentioned mm-hmm. to sea level rise. Those are the two kind of ones that I think everyone thinks about. But then you have a lot of different effects on sort of the various ecosystems of our world, whether that's an ecosystem that you experience in your backyard or otherwise.
Well, where in the United States and in what ways in the United States will we first notice the change, or will we be most impacted by the change if we don't contain this temperature rise?
I think, if we take Alaska, for example, would be a really good example of where we have experienced dramatic climate change. We've started moving. People have actually moved their villages inland because the storms have become more fierce as a result of declining ice pack that would have protected their villages from the winter storms.
I think the answer is everywhere. I mean, you've got, you know, the global ice caps are melting, so sea levels are rising. That'll affect coastal areas. The weather patterns have changed significantly, so we already are seeing a lot of this.
So are we talking
about... The storms are more serious?
Are we talking about Miami Beach being underwater?
Miami is a great example.
New York City being underwater?
Yeah, I mean, all these are going to be experiencing higher sea levels, and certainly within the next 10 years, 50 years, even 100 years. And those higher sea levels are not necessarily going to always flood the city, except maybe in the case of Miami. But then any storm that happens pushes more water into the city. And so the infrastructure is designed around a stable climate, and we're destabilizing climate. That's a big deal.
Leanne on Twitter wants to know why it's now called climate change and not global warming.
Global warming is the first aspect of climate change, the one that we all sense, that we can detect with thermometers, that we can relate to. It just is painting a picture of a general global environmental change.
So there's a cascade of issues under that we've been talking about. You know, sea level rise, climate, the weather patterns changes, droughts, that sort of thing. That's all. And under the umbrella of climate change.
I have 30 seconds. We may be pulling out of this agreement, but we're still at the table. We're still in it for 4 years, and that's another election cycle. Could we actually end up remaining in it if something happens in that election? And can we have an influence at the table even as we're pulling out for the next 4 years because we're still in it?
I think we really undercut ourselves. I think we've taken away our seat from the table for the negotiating standpoint. But well, there's a really good future from the state and from the cities, and I think that's really important.
Brian Maggie is associate professor of atmospheric sciences at UNC Charlotte. David Borix is an environmental reporter here at WFAE, and Camila Domonoske is a reporter for NPR, where she was in Washington. Thank you all for the hour.